Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Hello and welcome to The Corridor. I'm Dinah Jansen, and today I'm joined by CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative producer, Jesse Bell. Our first story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter, Christina Laurie, with an interview with Kingston author Julie Green.
Hello, I'm Christina Laurie, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca.
So to start us off, I was wondering, for those who don't know you yet, if you could introduce yourself and maybe share a bit about your connection to Kingston.
Ooh, okay. So I'm a writer. I was born in Cornwall, Ontario, and lived in England for, gosh, a decade, lived in Toronto for another decade. And then in the height of COVID, for some strange reason, we randomly decided to move to Kingston and have been here ever since. And we love it. So that's what, almost 5-6 years.
My first question was just that you've lived and written here in Kingston. I was wondering if you could speak a bit to how the local community shaped both your writing and the experiences that you've written about.
Well, the funny thing is, when I was first moving in Kingston, I actually got a little bit more involved in the visual art scene. I was, that's always been a passion of mine as well. So I was sort of dividing my time with a little bit of freelance writing. But actually I was getting kind of involved in some of the local galleries here. I was with Martello and Frameworks and just found that quite a nice community to get involved with, and actually haven't really got too involved in the writing scene here. Writing's such a, it's a very isolating thing, or it can be. I probably should try. It's hard to kind of break through that anxiety and connect with people through what's normally a very private experience. But now I'm having to do a lot of that. But no, initially my breakthrough in getting sort of settled in Kingston. First there was the delay with the pandemic. We moved to this beautiful city, and I remember how difficult it was, because you'd look around all these amazing storefronts and all these shows. Well, you know, the Grand was there, all these places, the Screening Room, some of my favorite places now were just shuttered. And it was torture, because we couldn't go in anywhere. So there was such a delay in just kind of being able to explore the city properly. So it took us a while for it to feel home, I think. But when I did start, it was actually through the visual arts community here instead, where I started to connect with people.
Wow. Yeah. And also kind of on this local note, there's a lot of conversation about inclusivity and awareness, and we have a lot of great resources and community here. But where do you see progress locally, and where do you think we still have some work to do?
I think things are changing. I mean, I think there's obviously a lot really turning with females and like certain marginalized groups that were missed that are now being identified. So that accounts for why it seems like there are more neurodivergent people now. So there's definitely much more awareness. On a local level, I mean, I'm not entirely sure. We've had a very good relationship with my son's school that's developed over years, and it's been amazing because he's been able to be at the same place since middle school. And he's definitely had a lot more, being a smaller city than Toronto, he's had a lot more individualized support. And, you know, I've gotten to know like the same teachers, the same principal. So we've really been able to develop connections there to get that support. But even in terms of Queens, actually, my son did a mentorship program here let me see, last year, actually 2 years. And he's extremely passionate. I write a lot about it, but his major passion is linguistics. And he was able to connect with a linguistics student here. And they would meet up every week and just chat. So it was nice to, it was a very cool community program. I think it was through Community Living in Kingston that set that up. And that was a very cool thing, initiative that Queens were involved in as well.
You speak a lot about being diagnosed later in life. And as a woman, I was wondering if you could just, you know, speak to that and how you hope your story will help other adults who are maybe experiencing the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a clinician, so I can't. I mean, there's just so much more information now. I think from my understanding, the DSM, which is the diagnostic manual that contains all of these things, it's changed so much over the years. And it was very much the testing and the manual and everything and all the research that was done. I mean, this happens for a lot of medical research, not just autism, things that are autism related, but, you know, girls weren't included in the research. And I think hopefully with that changing and they will hopefully broaden even and adapt some of the main, I think it's something called the ADOS, which is the main measure. It's one test, one form that you fill in, a diagnostic test basically to see, but it leaves out a lot of the nuance in female presentation. Like masking is a very big part of how autism presents in a lot of females. So I hope with time they're going to sort of evolve the whole diagnostic process. And I know some clinicians are much more aware of it now, but it takes a long time for these sort of things to catch up and change. So I see it changing. It's just, you know, the scientific community. I mean, there are studies, things are happening now, and we're just waiting for maybe the next, I believe the next edition or version of the DSM will include masking and will include sort of a wider presentation so that maybe it will be easier to identify girls who, so they won't have to wait till they're 44 to realize, you know, that they are autistic and rather than internalize things as being personality flaws or, you know, what's wrong with me? Why can't I do that? Why am I like this? They'll actually have a better understanding for their neurotype rather than attributing it to like a personality flaw or personality defect.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned you've already been getting some feedback from readers. I was wondering if you could speak a bit to that. What have you been hearing?
Yeah, it's a little bit surreal. Like, yeah, I think one person said, oh, it's as if she like went inside my brain and, oh gosh, I don't know. Very, very touching things, which is still, I don't know. I can't quite wrap my head around it yet because writing is such a private thing. And I mean, obviously I had a publisher, I've been waiting, you know, to get it published. So, but I think there's this disconnect where you, it doesn't feel quite real that people out there in the world are suddenly going to be reading about these experiences you've had. I don't know why there's that disconnect, but it's finally occurring to me now that, oh, okay. Suddenly all these people will know these things about you in your life. Which is fine. That's the decision I've made, but it also is a little bit strange. And I mean, memoir is a weird beast. Like there's so much people might assume, oh, they suddenly know everything about you, but it's very sculpted and there's very much that you curate what you decide to leave in, what you decide to leave out. There are a lot of things I didn't put in this book. And a lot of things I chose to for various reasons. So, but it is just amazing to see these people, having that reaction and really feeling like they're seeing themselves. Because of course you hope that happens, I guess. Otherwise why write a book? But there's no real guarantee until suddenly it's out there and you honestly have no way of knowing if it's going to strike a nerve with people or what.
Some of the misconceptions that you're hoping to tackle here,
Yeah, I guess it's speaking to a little bit like what I talked about before. I feel, I mean, it is getting better in terms of media. I mean, but you still see these two, it's a real binary, this narrative that it's either autism's like a superpower or it's a tragedy. And, you know, we're just people. We're complex, nuanced people. And I just hope people can start to just see more of a complex, complex figures that we are. So we're not just all these, the stereotypes that we have in the media. But also, I mean, I would hope, I am not sure this will happen, but I hope that people who really don't know anything about autism will pick up a book like mine and walk in our shoes a little bit, understand what parents go through. There's so much judgment of parents, especially when their children have what they call behaviors. You know, they have meltdowns in public, and there's still so much criticism and judgment, you know, looking at parents and particularly mothers, like, you know, if you had just done, you know, it's a discipline issue, or you've done this wrong, or you've done that wrong. So I would love it if people who really don't know much about autism read this book, and, but as opposed to the people who are already going to see themselves. But I mean, both fantastic.
Mm-hmm. And where can folks find your book and also connect with you during this launch?
Oh, it will be, as they say, in places where all books are sold. It's available, all the booksellers, Amazon, Indigo, online. Locally, it's at Novel Idea. It's at Books on Main in Bath. It's in Gann.
Awesome. And you have your launch tomorrow. How are you feeling into that?
A lot more comfortable than I am right now because, you know, virtual, this is the ironic thing. While a lot of people were sort of languishing during the pandemic, autistic people were like, oh, this is amazing. I don't have to deal with, you know, sensory overwhelm and social, you know, confusion. And I can be at home and I can control all these variables. So for me, doing Zoom actually is a lot more comfortable. And it's a relief to finally know that it will be out there. It's felt like a very long time, but I'm really excited, and I'll be chatting with my editor, who's an amazing author in her own right, Jen Suk Fong Lee. So I think it'll be fun. It won't be super heavy. I'll be doing a reading and some, you know, Q&A at the end, and it should be fun.
Awesome. And I know there's a few other places folks can keep up with you, like your Substack and stuff, if you want to share.
I've been keeping a Substack newsletter for well over a year now. So, that's called The Autistic Mom. And chat about all kinds of things there. And it's, by and large, it's mostly free. There very, very rarely do I put a paywall on anything. So people can learn about different facets of autism there. I often, every month I feature someone as well. I have a Q&A with someone just to share, again, some of the variety and of different presentations of autism. So it's been, I really enjoy that as well.
Thank you, Chris. Next is Dinah Jansen with a story from the local journalism initiative reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, Keith Dempsey, about Gananoque Mayor John Beddoe's decision to add a public consultation piece to the 2026 budget process.
Thank you, Jesse. Mayor John Beddoes is introducing new measures aimed at increasing transparency in Gananoque's 2026 budget process, including a public consultation meeting where residents will have a chance to comment on the draft budget before it goes to council. The move adds a new stage to the process, giving residents, service clubs, the Chamber of Commerce, and the BIA an opportunity to weigh in before council deliberates. No date has yet been set, but Mayor Beddoes said the meeting will be announced in advance and held outside the normal working hours to encourage broader participation. Council is expected to review the proposed budget on December 4th and 5th. Members will have the ability to amend or veto portions of the draft before final adoption. Mayor Beddoes also highlighted the impact of Ontario's strong mayor powers, which places responsibility for overseeing and delivering a draft budget squarely on the mayor's office. He emphasized that while the powers have often been tied to housing, budget oversight is a separate responsibility. As mayor, this responsibility is non-transferable, Mayor Beddoes said, noting he issued directives in August 2025 to provide planning guidance for the 2026 budget. That guidance, he added, was drafted in consultation with the town CAO and treasurer and drew heavily on ideas raised by municipal managers earlier this year. Mayor Beddoes also walked back a controversial proposal that would have allowed bylaw officers to clamp the tires of out-of-province vehicles. The idea, initially aimed at Quebec-plated cars, prompted swift backlash from residents, councillors, and tourism advocates concerned about deterring visitors. Council recently received training on the implications of strong mayor powers. A follow-up discussion on the planning guidance issued by Mayor Beddoes has been deferred to a future public session. Thank you to Keith Dempsey for that story. Now over to Jesse Bell with a story from the LJR reporter for YGK News Owen Fullerton about a Queens-led model that can improve insomnia care.
Thank you, Dinah. A research team led by experts at Queen's University have developed an insomnia care model that they think will help people treat sleep issues and avoid dependence on prescriptions. The team, led by sleep expert Dr. Judith Davidson, put together a stepped care model that aims to boost access to cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, as a primary step in insomnia care, and emphasize a self-guided approach to treating sleep disorders. The study, which was published earlier last month, highlights that while CBT for insomnia is an effective treatment and a recommended response, access is limited and inequitable. Catherine Fretz, a postdoctoral fellow at Queen's and a registered psychologist, says the primary response for insomnia and sleeping problems is prescription medication, while more basic and cheaper interventions are not even tried. She says people suffering from insomnia are often waiting for specialized care when self-guided treatments may have been all that was necessary. Quote, right now, the way insomnia care is happening in Canada is that people are waiting for these more specialized treatments that they might not actually need, Fretz said. Fretz says that many people don't even know that CBT is a recommended first step treatment for insomnia. But with more and more people struggling with sleep, nearly half of Canadians reporting issues falling or staying asleep, while 1 in 6 meet the criteria for insomnia disorder, there is more of a desire for accessible and self-guided aids. She says, especially in a healthcare system where so many people lack access to a primary care provider, increasing accessibility to treatment that people can deliver themselves is a need. Encouraging doctors to make patients aware of CBT as an effective first-line treatment is a big part of the model, as there can be a misconception that people would prefer to just take a pill when they often believe it's their only option. Fretz says that the effects of CBT treatment can be fairly clearly seen in real time if patients buy in. While CBT as a first step treatment to insomnia and sleep disorders may not be common knowledge, the idea of lack of sleep becoming an epidemic and the role of sleep in a healthy lifestyle has become a popular talking point. Biohacking and optimizing sleep have made their way more into the mainstream, with supplements and devices meant to act as sleep aids being recommended for purchase. Fretz says, however, for people who suffer from sleep disorders, this type of hypervigilance around sleep could actually have adverse consequences. The findings reported were published in coordination with the Canadian Sleep Research Consortium.
And thank you to Michelle Dory Forstell for that story. Now over to the LJR reporter for CJAI-FM Amherst Island Radio, Ted Evans, with a story covering a proposal to build a large-scale solar farm in Loyalist Township.
Hi, I'm Ted Evans, local journalism initiative reporter and news director at CJAI, Amherst Island Radio, 101.3 FM in Stella, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories from Loyalist Township. You can hear Amherst Island Radio's news program, North Shore News, on 101.3 Amherst Island Radio or online at cjai.ca. For showtimes throughout the week, check the schedule on our website at cjai.ca. Westbridge Renewable Energy has recognized there's still work to be done in gaining public support for their proposed solar farm in Loyalist Township. The company has committed to undertake Indigenous and community engagement activities and incorporate the feedback as the project moves forward. Chief Operating Officer for the company and Vice President of Switzerville Solar, Margaret McKenna, explains where they're at with the project.
During consultation, we've heard positive, we've heard negative, and we've heard constructive. We believe most of that can be incorporated, mitigated, or overcome in future planning and design. There is work to be done still. And we acknowledge that. We believe that the project will have a positive impact on the community and the township as a whole, while also contributing clean, emission-free energy to support Ontario's future.
While still showing support for the project, council is making sure the company does their due diligence. Development Services Manager with the Township, Andrea Furness, details some of the environmental work that will need to be done.
As part of the planning application, we would require an environmental impact assessment on that property. There is environmental protection lands going through the property, traversing the property through the water course. So that would be a requirement. We would they would have to address everything on species at risk habitat, wildlife habitat. All of that would have to be looked at by an ecologist. And the township uses a third party peer reviewer to evaluate that as well. Determine if there's impacts and to help form how any development can occur on the site without negatively impacting any natural heritage features and their ecological functions.
Deputy Mayor Nathan Townend noted council's position.
There are some concerns. The proponent recognized that there is homework yet to be done, and I think there's a recognition that council wants to ensure that that homework is done.
Council passed a resolution in support of the company at their latest meeting to help with the company's bid for federal funding. At an August 25th open house regarding the project, there were various concerns from residents in regards to communication, groundwater, and the potential to destroy wildlife habitat. Councillor Paul Broderick speaks about the importance of public engagement and moving towards clean energy options in the future.
We've been down this road before, and I think back early in our term of council, we asked staff to develop a policy in terms of engagement, and they followed that rather extensively. You know, clean energy, it in my judgment, that's where the direction we should be taking. It fits into our climate action plan.
Councillor Lorna Willis sympathized with those voicing concerns, but spoke about the importance of moving forward as well.
I do know what it's like to live within a project space. Although, you know, I am supporting the motion because I do agree that we do have to do our part to move forward with green energy in the township.
The proposed project would be located on approximately 800 acres of private land near Switzerville and would be capable of supplying energy to 20,000 homes. The target operation date is May 2030. For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Thank you to Ted Evans for that story. Coming up next, we have a story from the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CJPE, Brenda Little, about the upcoming county marathon.
This past Sunday was a picture-perfect day in Prince Edward County for the 2025 county marathon. It was a record-setting year with over 1,600 participants running in one of three races offered, the 42.2-kilometer full marathon, the half, or the new 5K Run for Fun event. The picturesque route attracted many locals, but others came from as far away as Saskatoon, Ottawa, Gatineau, and Toronto, and a 15-year-old lad came from Vancouver attempting to set a record. He tells us more.
What's your name?
Sir Darnie John.
And where are you from?
Vancouver.
And you're here to do this marathon?
Yes.
Is this the first time you've done a marathon?
Official.
Okay, and what are you trying to... you're the youngest? What are you trying
to... Yes, youngest person to complete a record marathon in a set amount of time.
I spoke to a couple of runners new to the course and Prince Edward County.
Yeah, it's my second marathon. I did the Toronto Marathon back in May, but this is my second one, so it's going to be fun.
Yeah, so you've never done it in the county.
It looks nice out here.
Yeah,
so
it is.
The bus riding is really nice.
So you're from Toronto, or?
I'm from the Durham region, yeah.
Oh, Durham, yeah.
Not too far.
When did you start marathoning?
December of last year.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So you're a newbie.
I'm a newbie, yeah.
Yeah, good for you. And are you planning on doing any other marathons?
I'm going to do the Toronto one again next year, hopefully, and just see where the journey takes me.
Right.
Yeah,
thank you so much.
No
thank
problem.
You.
Yeah.
Hi there. Would you mind speaking to me? I'm Brenda Little from County FM. It's the local radio station here. And how long have you been marathoning?
I marathoned in May for the first time.
Oh, wow. You're another newbie.
I am another newbie. Yeah, I did. But I also did two ultras as well, which is 50K or 100K.
Good.
So
very
more
good.
Than a marathon.
Yeah, so this is your first time here then?
First time in Canada doing a marathon.
Oh, where do you usually marathon?
I lived in France for the last 14 months. So I did it all there, and then I moved back here to Ottawa.
Oh, I see.
Yeah,
I see. Very nice. Very nice. Well, you're in for a treat here.
I think so, yeah.
Organizers Brian and Trish McLean took over the event 2 years ago, making this a Boston Marathon qualifier. Brian was a marathoner, and being sight and hearing impaired, he established Achilles Canada in 1999, which is part of the Achilles International, a not-for-profit organization encouraging disabled people to run. Trish McLean tells us more.
Brian's been running Achilles Canada, which is a running club for people with disabilities in Toronto. He's reaching the 28th year with his race there. It's a 5K, 10K, and we have a great time. And when this event came up, we jumped on it thinking Picton is where we want to spend our retirement days. And so we saw the opportunity, and here we are.
Finishing the route in Picton, Romain Carrette was the winner of the full marathon with a time of 2 hours and 35 minutes. This year, the money raised from the marathon went to the Prince Edward Hospital Foundation. For the Local Journalism Initiative, FrequencyNews.ca and CJPE County FM, I'm Brenda Little.
Thank you to Brenda Little for that story. Over now to the local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFWN Coburg, Dan Jones.
A grade 8 teacher from Port Hope accused of 18 crimes, including making child pornography and sexual assault of a minor under the age of 14, is expected to make a guilty plea in November. The name of the accused is protected under a publication ban. At a brief appearance in a Coburg court this morning, a defense attorney confirmed that a guilty plea will be entered in a Peterborough court November 6th. The accused was not in court, and her legal representation appeared via video. The teacher, who was on leave from her job, was arrested in August 2024 in what investigators allege that a boy came forward accusing her of inappropriate touching on a school trip. Three other minors accuse her in complaints as well. The incidents are alleged to have occurred between June 2022 and April 2024, all taking place in the Port Hope area. She is also accused of communicating with the complainants through social media. Other charges include luring a person under the age of 16 via telecommunications, distribution of child pornography, and invitation to sexual touching. A few months after her initial arrest, she was apprehended again for allegedly failing to abide by bail conditions, as she is accused of visiting public parks in Peterborough and Whitby. A guilty plea was scheduled for earlier this year, which was brought up by Justice Mark Moorcroft today. It is not clear what charges she will plead guilty to or whether sentencing will take place as well. Reporting for CFWN and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Dan Jones.
And thank you to Dan Jones for that story. Next up is Jesse Bell with CFRC's Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region.
Thank you, Dinah. This is your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. We begin with Thursday, October 9th, coolest day of the autumn thus far, high of 13 degrees, dropping down to 6 overnight. It will be a beautiful sunny day, however. Friday, October 10th, daytime high of 15 degrees, mix of sun and cloud, dropping down to 10 overnight. Saturday, October 11th, a little bit warmer, high of 16 degrees, mix of sun and cloud, dropping down to 7 overnight. Sunday, October 12th, we've got an identical temperature line, 16 with a little bit more sun, but still dropping down to 7 overnight. Monday, October 13th, daytime high of 17 degrees, mostly cloudy, a little bit of sun sneaking through here or there. Tuesday, October 14th, 17 degrees with a 55% chance of precipitation. Wednesday, October 15th, 17 degrees with an 81% chance of precipitation. And then towards the end of next week, Thursday, October 16th, daytime high of 17. Beautiful sunny day.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via CFRC.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of the Plugged In My Ears podcast. I'm Adam, here with Kyle and Sam. We've got a lot to talk about today, gentlemen. We've got Connor McDavid signing, we got the Toronto Blue Jays, and then Jake Walman signing too. So let's dive into those Oilers signings, because I feel like that's kind of the biggest news right now in hockey, besides obviously opening night tonight. But Connor McDavid signs a 2-year contract with the Edmonton Oilers before the season starts. I mean, what are our thoughts on this? I remember we were talking about this a couple of weeks back, and myself with expert insight and my source close to the Oilers said that they were going to sign him before the season started, and that's what happened. But are you guys surprised at all by the 2-year deal or the amount? Your thoughts, Sam?
I did not think that McDavid was this selfless. I thought he was going to ask for a bit more money. Granted, I will say you both called it. You both said he was going to sign a short-term contract and that it would probably manifest itself like this. And I actually do like what he did. I think he's really trying to give Edmonton one last chance to win the Stanley Cup. That's the only reason why I could see him deciding not to take a full $17 million like he probably could have taken had he wanted to. But it's also a clear indication to the Oilers that if it doesn't work in the next 2 years, he's going to go somewhere else where it might work. And that is a reality that Edmonton is pushing to the side. But they have to deal with that this year more likely than next, if I were to put myself in the shoes of management over there, because I was looking at this earlier. Darnell Nurse's contract goes up in 2030. Evan Bouchard's in 2029. That's a lot of money to spend on guys who turn the puck over 24/7. If you lose a dude like McDavid and you haven't won the Stanley Cup in the next 2 years, your team is automatically relegated to San Jose level. That's really bad. Really bad. So they got to do something quick to win the Stanley Cup, or else they're going to lose a chance to do so for the next 10 years.
Kyle, any thoughts?
Carney's got a lot on the table for negotiations. It looks like, you know, one of his deals has gone through. I don't know about the other one. There's some problems on that end, but this one went through. So he's pretty happy about that one. It's a major discount, I have to say. I mean, everyone was a bit surprised. Bit surprised with the number, I would say. I heard some fair criticisms, though, that, signed discount McDavid, then dumped the rest of the coal in the fire right away after signing Walman to a pretty pricey contract as well. So
yeah,
small savings to not really much savings. Still got goalie problems. But, no, I think it's a pretty big power move by McDavid. I mean, yeah, he could have taken $17 million and the team would have been not good. at all yeah. for the next like foreseeable future. But honestly, it makes sense for him to wait it out a bit, I think, because he can re-sign 2 years from now for probably what, 20?
Yeah.
Because of the cap increase.
Yeah,
he'll
probably get that to go up, yeah.
So he'll probably get, you could probably sign for 10 by 20, like 200 million. I could literally see something like that crazy.
Yeah, so something like something larger to beat Kaprizov's contract. But yeah, I mean, I guess I'll ask the question now. Does locking up McDavid make the Oilers cup favorites at this point? I mean, they were there last year and Florida's really beat up. So, I mean, is Edmonton now the favorite this year going in? Or do you guys think they can get it done within this 2 years that McDavid's given them?
I think Edmonton is the favorite. And I mean, as in my personal view, I know Power Ranking says that too, mm-hmm. although that doesn't really mean too much. But I also don't really know of any team that's as well poised as Edmonton is roster wise. Edmonton's defensive core is maybe not elite, but it's pretty good. And their offensive core is pretty elite. So they're pretty solid. Like, I actually can't think of a single team that has a better roster combination than they do right now. The only team that does, and this is a crazy take, but maybe Dallas, and I don't know if that's true. I don't think Dallas is the same high-end talent. I just think they're really consistent across the board. But I don't think Dallas is going to do that great, and Edmonton already showed they can shut Dallas down. But it wasn't easy for them to do it.
Yeah. No.
I think Vegas is pretty scary.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Like, the thing about Vegas is they've got a lot of guys that, I mean, whether or not they have real injuries, I don't know. They seem to show up on the IR sheet, but they've got, you know, Eichel or something. If he goes down with an injury, yeah, I think that they'd have potentially some issues. But right now, they're on paper, they look pretty darn good, I have to say.
Yeah. No, I think they're definitely one of my favorite teams to come out of the West at this point. I think getting McDavid signed is a huge, like, distraction avoidance. So I think that going into the season, the team's going to be focused. They know that McDavid's bought in for 2 more years. That's their leader, right? I'm looking at their roster, and aside from the fact that Zach Hyman will probably be coming back from injury, I don't know a few of these names on the set of their forwards. I feel like the first line right now is probably going to be Draisaitl, McDavid, and Trent Frederick on the right wing. Now, I'm not too familiar with Trent Frederick's game, but I do feel like that is kind of they're kind of weak at right wing. I mean, Trent Frederick, Matthew Savoy, David Tomasek, and Kasperi Kapanen are their right wingers right now. I don't know if this is the most deep team I've ever seen, but we've looked the last few, like Florida winning the cup the last 2 years, they've had to be deep teams. Both teams were super deep. And I don't know if Edmonton's got that in their forwards. I know, Sam, you talked about their defense, and like their defense, I think, is honestly one of the bright spots of this team. Their goaltending and their forward depth, I think that's kind of where they kind of fall off. I mean, even watching them last year, as soon as McDavid and Draisaitl were off the ice, I mean, it was kind of a totally different team. Like, you kind of could guess that the Oilers were not going to score when McDavid or Draisaitl were both off the ice at the same time. Like, it didn't look good. But I don't know. I think we'll be the season's a long season. There's going to be injuries. They signed or claimed Connor Ingram, I believe, off waivers. So they have a third option at goalie if Skinner and Pickard don't work out. I still think they need a goaltender to be the favorite. I think I don't like Stuart Skinner's game. I don't think he is the answer right now. But I don't say that he was to blame in the finals. I think that, honestly, Skinner played all right in the finals. But it will be interesting to see, I think. But Wallman getting locked up, I think, is honestly, I think that's a big win. I don't know. Do you guys think Wallman's a big win, or do you think that's kind of an overpay for the Oilers?
You know what? I think I have, like, mixed opinions on it. I don't know. His track record is interesting because he was almost like borderline chased out of Detroit. So not a great start there. He played pretty well in San Jose, all things considered.
Yeah, the team was on.
He played pretty well last season. I don't know about that. I mean, the contract, I think right now I feel iffy about it, but I think it's because they think it's going to age better. Yeah. And maybe it will, maybe it won't. I think I'm going to say it's not a safe contract. I'm going to say it's on the riskier end of things.
Okay.
But I'm not like super, I wouldn't say it's terrible or like really good, but it could basically go either way. Just like a high risk investment.
Yeah, 7 years is a long investment in Jake Wallman, in my view. I don't know if he'll be worth $7 million 7 years from now, even though the cap's still going up. Mm-hmm. Because this is a pretty big investment on a guy who's good, but not destined to stay good. So yeah, they're going to have to get rid of him before the 7 years is up if they want to be able to do something useful with him in the future. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah. The way that I looked at it is like, I don't mind Jake Wallman as a player. So I kind of liked that the Oilers did lock him up this long. And I do think $7 million is pretty easy to move if it does come down to having to trade him 3 or 4 years down the line. The only red flag that I saw is comparing it to the Luke Hughes contract that was just signed last week. 7x9 for Luke Hughes, who has a lot more upside than Jake Wallman does. And that's, I mean, it's not obviously 7x9 is more than 7x7, but I still think that that's like setting the tone for a lot of these defensemen contracts. And the Wallman contract might not look too bad if he keeps up the play and the cap goes up, because the Luke Hughes contract seems to be affecting the Lane Hutson contract discussions right now, as Lane Hutson was prepared to take $9.5 million a couple weeks ago, but then Luke Hughes signed this 7x9 and is now looking for a little bit more, rightfully so. But I think that the fact that all of this is like happening right now with the Luke Hughes contract and the defensemen are like, okay, we're worth this value, I think the Wallman deal is pretty good compared to what they could have ended up overpaying. I think they could have ended up overpaying way more for Wallman than they ended up doing. So opening night is tonight. We've got a couple games on the slate. I am looking forward to the Montreal-Toronto game tomorrow, but tonight there's right now Blackhawks-Panthers, Penguins-Rangers, and Avalanche-Kings. If you ask me, kind of an underwhelming opening night. I don't know about you guys. Any thoughts on this? I know like Florida obviously was supposed to be a lot better, but I mean, I wasn't too high on any of these games tonight.
No, it's not a big opening night. I think the real opening night is always actually Saturday.
Yeah.
Like Saturday is actually hockey night in Canada. So that's when the actual like unofficial opening night is, at least in my opinion, usually.
No, I know what you mean. It was just, there was a comment made by an analyst over at ESPN, I think last week, that was talking about how the NHL opening night is starting on like the same night as game three of the ALDS and NLDS for the MLB. And he's like, yeah, I'm not going to be watching opening night hockey. And he's like one of the head analysts of like ESPN, and like ESPN covers hockey, ESPN covers baseball. So it's just kind of was an odd sight to see, I guess. But I mean, I don't really blame him. I feel like the lineups are not too great. Like Pittsburgh, a team that's like kind of projected to be a bottom team. The Rangers, a team that didn't make it last year. Chicago, a team that didn't make it last year, wasn't even close. Florida, like beat up team. And then Colorado, LA, I guess is the best game. But if you think I'm staying up till 10:30 to watch that, you're thinking wrong. So, I mean, I'm looking forward to the baseball tonight. I don't know. Are you guys tuning into the Jays Yankees tonight? It's a chance for the Jays to advance to the ALCS for the first time since 2015 when they did against the Kansas City Royals. I don't know. You guys turning in?
Maybe, yeah. I don't have really good reception here, but I'll see.
Oh, yeah? Maybe you could listen on the radio.
True.
Yeah. Everyone needs a lullaby, Kyle.
Yeah.
Right.
No, but the Jays have been cooking recently. I don't know if you guys saw their first two games against the Yankees, but they blew them out both times. Vlad Guerrero Jr. had the first grand slam in the postseason by a Blue Jays hitter. Kind of historical stuff going on right now in Toronto, but the series switches over to New York. So now they're playing at Yankee Stadium. It'll be interesting to see how this goes. Did either of you guys check out any of the first two games, or was it kind of just saw about it on the news? Or
yeah, no, I saw some of the like clips from it, but I didn't watch the full thing. Yeah,
yeah. One of my housemates, Josh, actually went to the game where the grand slam happened, and he said it was the loudest moment he's ever been a part of. And we've talked about it before, but playoff baseball in Toronto is just completely different energy than any regular season baseball game you could go to. It's a really electric environment, especially when they're winning, but especially when they're hitting the ball really well. There's been a few Yankees fans that are that are saying that the Jays are cheating, actually. They're stealing signs, that they have but if you look at it, the Jays have a crazy home record. They're like 54-27 at home this year, and then like 40-41 on the road. So, which is kind of, it's not really concerning. I think the Yankees fans are trying to cope with getting blown out by the Blue Jays twice. But it is kind of interesting and funny to see the Yankees fans kind of struggling to identify what the issue is. But I mean, I don't know. People are thinking it's like another Houston Astros incident. But any thoughts on that?
All I'm going to say is, me hearing the Yankees having trouble with accountability does not surprise me. They're suffering large issues with that across the board. So, you know, let's just say that's right in line with what I expected.
No, fair enough. Sam?
Yeah, I don't know if I can say much more than that either, although I will say that this tends to be a thing for American fans when Canadian teams do better.
Yeah.
There's always an excuse, and you know, you can't blame them. The United States is predicated upon a dream, and we're predicated upon a promise. and that is the promise to attain glory. For them, it's a dream, and sometimes it comes true. Yet for us, it's manifest destiny. So I don't blame them for trying to come up with excuses, but unfortunately, the gods of baseball don't bow to excuses.
That's right. A good point, then, Sam.
Another contract that got signed was Philip Gustavson on Minnesota for 6.8. And man, honestly speaking, those kind of contracts, it kind of hurts when you're like a team looking for a goalie and you're seeing teams sign one for that cheap. But the only way to get a deal like that is if you have a good like system of acquiring rookie goalies. It seems is the only way to get a good goalie nowadays.
Yeah, and rookie goalies take a really long time to develop too. I think of Sebastian Casa, who's over in the Detroit Red Wings system, not Detroit Lions. He's in the Detroit Red Wings AHL program, and he was like one of the top highly touted goaltending prospects like 5 or 6 years ago. And he's maybe ready to start in the NHL this year. Like, maybe starting to get some starts as a backup. Like, a solid goaltender is a 5-6 year investment to properly develop them. And, I mean, we look at teams like the Oilers that are struggling to get goalies, and, like, have they ever really developed a goalie? Ever? Like, since what, Grant Fuhr? Like, I can't remember a time that Edmonton had, like, a homegrown drafted goalie.
I can't actually think of one, really.
Yeah.
Man.
Ben Scrivens? Was he like the last homegrown goalie in Edmonton?
Yeah. I think he actually was. That's crazy.
Like, No, Scrivens was on the Leafs. I think he was on the Leafs first. I can't remember. But, like, I mean, you look at teams like, I mean, I don't want to toot my team's horn, but the Montreal Canadiens, I mean, if anything, they're like a powerhouse for developing goaltenders. I mean, Patrick Waugh, Carey Price, like Jose Theodore, won a Vezina with the Habs. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, like, all guys that were drafted and developed, it's obviously not the same as it used to be. Goalies used to be thrusted kind of into the spotlight quicker, but now they have time to develop. So I think, honestly, like, if Edmonton could go back a couple of years and maybe draft like Philip Gustavson, they could be looking completely different right now, right? So
that's a good point. To be fair though, I mean, how, you know, Montreal obviously is doing a better job developing goalies, but the fact that they were able to turn poo into gold with Samuel Montembeau is kind of an exception to the rule. He wasn't drafted by Montreal, but they turned rubbish into something
I'll tell you a quick loophole on the goalie is just look for whatever Ottawa's trying to discard and pick it up, because I don't know what we do in Ottawa, but man, the number of good goalies that we've just shot out of there. And for nothing too, like we're almost paying teams to take good goalies from us. I don't know why, but Philip Gustavson came right from Ottawa system. So
yeah,
it's a strange one over there, but honestly, that's what I would be doing.
Yeah. No, I mean, I can't really see like who is they had a really good prospect, Merlinen or something. Levi Merlinen.
Mm-hmm.
He's pretty good. Is he still on the Senators?
No.
No. Is he off of them? I couldn't tell.
I don't think so.
Because they've got
either that or we've had at least like Yeah, we've had a handful of decent goalies pass through. I mean,
Merlinen's the backup. He's still the backup.
Okay. Oh, he still is. Okay.
Yeah. All right.
Because Ottawa really has no excuse, though, because Devin Levi ended up being a diamond in the rough, and he literally played where the Sens arena is. He played for Carlton Place. And they didn't even show up to one of his single games to watch him. You know what their scouting report was on him? If he was actually good, he would have played in the QMJHL instead of choosing to go to the NCAA. But Buffalo is laughing now. They could have driven 10 minutes down the road to Carlton Place's arena and just seen this kid completely dominate a terrible league. Even though the league's terrible, he completely dominated it. And Ottawa has no excuse. They just do a bad job with goaltending.
We got good training, but nothing else.
Yeah, and I don't know how good Buffalo is at training goalies either. I guess this year will be a test. I mean, actually, I don't even know if Levi's starting. I probably shouldn't say that.
He's still developing, I think.
He's probably going to play half the games this year, though, if I had to guess.
Maybe. Yeah, he started for some last year. He didn't play many, though.
Yeah, he had 20-something starts last year. I could see him getting 40-ish this year.
They do have Luukkonen, who is a really good starter, like, right now. He's developed really well. Buffalo's pretty good in the goaltending category right now.
Buffalo looks good on paper, man, but I don't know what they just don't have any finish at all.
I mean, I think this is the year. Screens. I think this is the that's a good one, Sam. That's great. Hilarious. Yeah. We need a laugh track on here just for your little quips, man. But I think this is the year for the Sabres. I think they've got it. I think they're knocking Ottawa out of that last wild card spot. It's gonna be Montreal and Buffalo this year, guys.
No way. I think there's no way. Ottawa looks way better than Buffalo, man.
No, I know. I don't think Buffalo's got a shot this year. I mean,
how do we feel about Boston? I still think they're race to the basement bottom here, but I don't think they're doing too much.
I'm torn on the Bruins because I look at them and I'm like, yeah, this team is definitely like falling apart and they're definitely like in a rebuilding process. But like, I swear, like it would not surprise me if this team like somehow manages to sneak into the wild card. Like, I feel like the Bruins are always pretty good. You know what I mean? And I think that, like, I kind of think back to Montreal under Marc Bergevin, where, like, they never went into a full rebuild and they just decided to, like, constantly try and, like, upgrade every year in free agency and, like, not really take care through the draft. They would have, like, one bad year and then they'd be, like, the 8 seed or the 7 seed and make the playoffs the next year. Like, mainly because Carey Price was carrying them, but... Also, I think the Bruins have like solid goaltending. Like, I think the Bruins, like Swayman is a solid goaltender that could carry. I mean, if he goes back to the way that he was playing when he won like the when he won the Vezina a couple years ago, correct? Yeah, like I mean, he could carry that team to the playoffs. I think Boston's got some of the best goaltending in the league, and I think goaltending is very important. Pasternak is still a great sniper. I think one of the top 10 goal scorers in the league, honestly. So I wouldn't count them out. I mean, it's easy to because they're so like weak everywhere else. But I mean, I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised if they somehow sneak into the playoffs. And I can see teams like Detroit and Buffalo like slipping up. Even Montreal, I can see them slipping up, and maybe Boston having a decent year and getting.
I actually see Montreal doing pretty good, frankly.
Oh yeah, I don't know if I'm. Like I'd still be a little nervous on Swayman. I have to say, last year was pretty abysmal. Yeah. I mean, he missed training camp and whatever, but I don't know. He didn't play well the whole season, which just seemed abnormal. I mean, his team suffered greatly. He also, they were missing some players. Like, fair enough, but I don't know. If he doesn't bounce back this year, I'd be pretty nervous on him if I was them.
Yeah, no, and that's fair enough. I just don't think that they're like, I don't think Boston's mentality going into this is that they're a bottom feeder. I think that they're going to have the expectation that they make the playoffs, like them as the team. I don't think like analysts really think Boston's going to do anything just compared to the other teams in the Atlantic. And honestly, the Atlantic is one of the toughest divisions, if not the toughest division in the NHL right now. So, I mean, it will be really interesting to see what Boston does. But I don't know. I saw another note that the Leafs are looking at trying to acquire a former Ottawa legend in Erik Karlsson. Like, they're still trying to reach out and get him from Pittsburgh. I haven't really heard much about Erik Karlsson's camp. I haven't heard much about his preseason. Pittsburgh, I feel like, is just in such a odd place right now. Like, it can't be fun to be in that locker room. Like, I feel like everyone's in trade rumors. Like, every good player on that team is in trade rumors right now.
So they just signed Artiri Seelofs, whatever.
Oh, yeah, Seelofs is their starting goalie.
He's their starter.
He's starting
tonight,
yeah.
You know what? Like, I was like, okay, whatever. But I saw all these comments from, like, Pens fans that were super amped about this. And I was like, do you not? Like, this guy, like, was exposed as having major, major weaknesses as a goaltender in NHL right away. Yeah. And, like, you can watch, like, I watched a full breakdown of his, like, weakness, but it's essentially low blocker side. Like, he just gives up freebies. Like, I don't know if maybe he's supposedly fixed that, but it was pretty bad. So when he played a couple games and just got annihilated last season.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I'd be pretty scared about that one, especially as a starter. Like, I don't know. He has not demonstrated that he was even remotely starter material, in my opinion. But yeah, that's pretty nervous. And then the Erik Karlsson one. I don't even know. I don't know what Toronto would be doing with that. That doesn't make any sense.
I feel like it's a weird acquisition for Toronto. Like, I feel like they're just like grasping at straws right now. Like, Erik Karlsson is not going to turn your team into a contender. Like,
yeah,
I don't know.
I saw a quote the other day that I really liked. It said, "The asylum is almost full in Toronto." after hearing bad trade rumor talks, and I was like, "Yeah, that sounds about right."
Yeah, no,
oh
it
my
is
God, that's funny.
Definitely an exciting time. I actually can't wait to see one player I'm really looking forward to seeing is Jonathan Toews coming back and playing for Winnipeg. Now, I'm not excited to see him because I think he's going to be the Jonathan Toews that was captain of the Chicago Blackhawks during those Stanley Cup Finals runs, but he's been out of the league for like 2 years now. So it'll be interesting to see how he comes back and plays because, I mean, I don't know. Do you think he'll be a good addition to the Jets? He's kind of been like everyone saying he's a great addition. I don't know if I'm fully convinced on that. Like, I guess he could bring leadership, but I don't know what his skill level is going to be like. What do you guys think? I think that's a long time for him to be off.
Honestly, I think the Jets right now are such a good team that honestly, like, I would say that their main thing they do need is leadership because that's clearly the problem. Like, you know, Hellebuck loses his edge or whatever it is in the playoffs. I don't know what goes on there.
Mm-hmm.
And then the rest of the team seem to also have similar problems where they're just not like they're just, yeah, they have trouble kind of dealing with the pressure almost. That's what I would say. I mean, that being said, I always say that Hellebuck's stats from the regular season are super inflated from like how good of a goalie he actually is. Like he's not that good. Like Vasilevsky continuously ranked number one.
Oh, okay, all right.
Every year.
I was gonna say Hellebuck's pretty good. I mean, like, I guess when you compare him to Vasilevsky and Shesterkin, maybe like, yeah.
Oh yeah.
Get up
but
there,
I'm saying like their numbers are worse, despite them being better. So
right.
He's still like his drop off in performance is so high between regular season and playoffs that it's questionable. Yeah.
Yeah, Sam, what do you think about Toews?
Well, it's probably good that he's coming back, and it will likely help, but let's not act like Toews is coming back with the most perfect and elite state of mind.
Yeah.
And I, you know, Winnipeg has a bit of a culture issue, not in the sense they have a bad culture. They just don't really have a winning culture, and I think that's why they fumble the bag in playoffs a lot. Every once in a while, the camera will come to their bench, and you can see they look really, really beaten down mm-hmm. when things aren't going their way, and that's not something you can have. And obviously, Toews has won the Stanley Cup a few times, so he knows how to get through adversity, but he also did leave for health reasons and mental health reasons.
Yeah.
Right. And I'm not going to say that that's a bad thing to do. Not at all. But my point is, as much as he might be able to help guide the team towards developing a better mindset, it would be illogical to assume that he's coming in with the most perfect and pristine mindset that he's ever had.
No.
And granted, going through stuff definitely helps, and it probably does give him a new perspective on life. But I don't think it's going to be as though he's walking in and completely revitalizing the locker room.
Yeah.
He's a great addition to the team, but he will not be carrying the mental weight that is necessary to carry a team on one's shoulders. And someone's got to do it on their team, because right now no one's doing it.
Yeah, well, there's only one way to find out, and that is to watch the NHL. Opening week is this week. We'll be tuning in and ready to talk about it next week when we see you on Plugged in My Ears. Thanks.
As the cooler weather sets in the Kingston area, CFRC and KPP concerts are turning up the heat with a stacked fall lineup. On October 10th, check out Shania Twink, followed by the Arrogant Worms on October 11th at Broom Factory. Sloan hits the Ale House on October 18th, and folks can catch the Grapes of Wrath on October 22nd, Crywank on November 1st, and Georgia Harmer on November 8th at the Broom. Billy Pfaffel, Guy Davis, and Rhea May are also playing at the Broom on November 12th, 15th, and 16th, respectively. For a complete list of shows and ticket information, visit kppconcerts.com.
Yo, Ellie.
Hey, Nate. What's up?
Well,